Well, I thank you all very much for coming back. I know it's hard when you sit and wait all morning and then your number isn't called. But you are nice to come back, and we look forward to hearing what you have to say. Attorney Schreiner, I think you were in the midst of starting to answer a question from Justice Bradley, but perhaps she will repeat for all of us what she had in mind, and then we will begin there.
The room full of people when I was here last, I wondered if it was something I said.
No, I don't think so.
I have a smart comment on the tip of my tongue, and I'm going to bite that tongue right now. Yes, indeed. Thank you for your indulgence on this. There are two areas of concern that I have. And one is, of course, the obvious is that this is a rule of procedure, right? But to me, that does not answer the full question. That's only the threshold question. The full question is, does this rule of procedure affect, modify substantive rights? Because a rule of procedure can do that. And so that's my first area of concern. I'm going to paint my two areas and then get to a specific question. My second area of concern is, what are we doing, I say to myself, and now I say to you, fooling around with Chapter 426, the Wisconsin Consumer Code? I can be wrong on this, but to my knowledge, that's always been the bailiwick of the legislature. And are we able then in areas of substantive law to dive in and say, this pertains to something in court, so we can change what has always been someone else's bailiwick? And so it's the separation of powers kind of thing. So let me start with the first of the two, specifically with regard to the rights. In your memo, and you again, at the end of the morning, pointed me to pages 3 and 4 of your memo. But as it continues on page 8, and I'm going to read from the very top of that, the first full sentence on page 8 of your memorandum. And it says, finally, the United States... Are you there? I don't want to go ahead.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Finally, the United States Supreme Court has commented that the purpose of 23B3 class is to vindicate the rights of those claimants who individually would be unable to bring their claims against opponents in the court. These classes have two additional requirements to meet: predominance and superiority. The gist of my concern is, I have understood over the years that generally, perhaps it's because of a lack of specificity, that it has been easier to get a class certified in Wisconsin state court than in federal court. My understanding may be incorrect. This is anecdotal, but this is what I've heard over the years. And when I read the top of page 8, I know that under our case law, that we have required commonality, adequate representation, and numerosity. Those have been the essence of the analysis. And now it seems to me that we're adding additional things, additional requirements that have to be met that might make it harder to jump through the hoops in order to get a class certified. And as the top of page 8 indicates, the purpose is to vindicate the rights, the substantive rights, right? And so why isn't, this is my question with that by way of context, why isn't adding additional requirements affecting the substantive right to vindicate claimants who individually would be unable to bring their claims?
Let me begin by answering your first question, then the second, and then I'll try to bring it back to what I think your question is. First of all, Section 751.12, which gives this court the authority to adopt rules of procedure and to even amend statutes in the course of doing so, an extraordinarily broad power, does in fact impose a limitation that in doing so, the court may not, I want to pull the language.
It's on page 3 of your memo.
I also wrote it on the back of something where I could find it.
Okay.
That in doing so will not abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right.
Mm-hmm.
That language is identical to the language in 28 U.S.C. Section 2072. The Supreme Court of the United States also has the authority to promulgate rules of evidence, procedure, and so on. And in exactly that limitation, that may not abridge, enlarge, or modify any substantive right. Fortunately, I think, and this is really all I can say about it, if it doesn't persuade you, it doesn't persuade you, but the U.S. Supreme Court in 2010 decided the case that we cite, Shady Grove Orthopedic Associates versus Allstate Insurance Company, a plurality opinion by Justice Scalia, and dealt with a claim that by allowing class actions in cases removed from New York State Court, which did not allow class actions in certain circumstances, cases against the state, if I can come back to that, that the federal court was abridging, modifying, or enlarging substantive rights. And Justice Scalia took that on. It was the issue in the case. And he held the question isn't, does it, as you articulated it, and as many people do, does it affect substantive rights? He said, of course it does. Rules of procedure affect substantive rights all the time. You have to comply with the rules of procedure in order to vindicate your substantive rights. But the question is, does it enlarge, abridge, enlarge, or modify any
Okay,
substantive
and
rights?
My precise legal question right? is, adding additional requirements like predominance and superiority as threshold tests before you can get a class certified, it necessarily creates, makes it more difficult, and why isn't that abridging or modifying the existing right as set forth in our current statute?
Because it doesn't modify a substantive right. The substantive right in that case was the right to bring a claim against, I think, prison officials for misbehavior. The substantive right in a case may be a tort right or a contract right. There isn't a substantive right to have a case processed as a class action.
Well, on the top of page 8, you make it sound like it.
Well,
it says, purpose is to vindicate the rights of those who individually would be unable to bring their claim against the opponent.
Well, but the right that they have, whatever that right may be, a tort right or a contract right, is one that they retain, that they can proceed with an individual lawsuit to begin. And let me just back up a minute and say, I've litigated class actions in both federal court, more than in state court, but several of them in the Wisconsin courts. And there was a time when there was a perception on parts that it was easier to get a class certified in state court than in federal. I don't think that's the case anymore, Your Honor. And I think that is largely a result of the fact that without any authority to do so, state judges sensibly have been applying federal Rule 23 decisions to decisions about whether or not to certify a class. We effectively have in operation, and Judge Fitzpatrick can address this because it's something he's dealt with as a trial judge, effectively, because there's nothing else to look at, people look at federal precedent, they look at the very excellent treatise Newberg on class actions, which is all about federal class actions, and they apply those procedures. The only thing wrong with it is there's no authority to do that that derives from the sovereign state of Wisconsin. So unless either this court or the Supreme Court or the legislature adopts a class action rule that says a heck of a lot more than current 80308 says, which says basically nothing, it would be a good idea to have a class action sometime, is basically what the rule says, we don't have any rules. We don't know when a case comes in what ought to be taken into consideration in certifying a class. We don't know what kind of notice ought to go out. We don't know what procedures ought to be applied when the case is settled. We don't have any of that. We're flying blind. And you can make an argument that the court ought to adopt some other version of Rule 23, some other state's rule, although I'll point out that we, and I heard him talking about Missouri this morning, Nebraska this morning, Nebraska and California are the only three states that still have that field code provision. All the rest of them have given it up and gotten to some version of Rule 23. We ought to have rules. I meant that this morning quite seriously. I'm not flipping.
I understand that. And I, like Justice Kelly, am not grounded in a background of class actions. I think that accurately states what you indicated, Justice Kelly. And so I can appreciate the work that the Judicial Council did in putting greater form and character and definition to these mere 49 words of our long-existing statute. But although I don't know, have experience in class actions, I do have experience in 751.12. And that's what is the genesis of my concern. Are we, by making it tougher to vindicate substantive rights, whatever the area of substantive rights, vis-a-vis a class action certification, are we modifying or abridging access to that substantive
My right? answer to that is I don't think you're making it tougher. I really don't think.
We're adding more requirements as your predominance, whatever that means, superiority, whatever that means. It used to be that in Wisconsin, the circuit court was the one that determined the threshold of decision on manageability. Not so with this.
It still does. It's still well under this rule. But the point of it is, I think that everybody benefits. And if I may point out, we circulated what we were doing with this when this was in committee in the Judicial Council.
Yes, you circulated, I saw that.
You circulated against again after the petition was filed. There has been no opposition to this from either the plaintiff's bar or the defense bar, and we have widely publicized it. And I think the reason is all of us, and I've done both plaintiffs and defense class actions, all of us prefer to have rules and to know what we're doing. I don't think we're making it harder. I think this actually, for someone with a legitimate plaintiff's case and a class who wants to bring a class action, I think we're making it easier because we're saying this is how you do it.
We have a lot of new judges, too, and this rule will give new judges
right.
a better framework under which to operate when the questions
are whole body. Again, it won't be authoritative because the source of authority there is a federal court, not you. It'll be authoritative only when you and the Court of Appeals and published decisions say something. But up until then, you've got something to look at. Other judges have looked at this before.
What does, you speak of authority. My second issue, of course, is
466.
What are we doing getting into consumer? 426. But you mentioned authority, which brings up the question, what about those several Court of Appeals decisions and Supreme Court decisions that have discussed class actions
right.
and the necessary requirements? What does this do to those cases?
They're persuasive or not. They're not authoritative.
Fair enough.
They're not authoritative.
Persuasive.
I get a kick all the time out of people who rely on trial court decisions because, of course, in federal court, they publish some of their trial court decisions.
I'm talking about in our, we have, Nolte versus Michael's Pipeline. We have Brown versus Milwaukee Board, all of those cases.
As Judge Fitzpatrick points out to me all the time, though, we don't have anything from this court since Alice Chalmers versus whatever it was in 1979 when he was in high school. So it hadn't been, this subject has not been given a lot of attention by this court.
Absolutely. Let's move then.
Tell
me why we should be doing this. This causes me a little concern. I don't recall ever us going into someone else, what has been their exclusive bailiwick, and just taking a little bit of the procedure, because, of course, we're authorized to deal with procedure.
426.110 was something that the legislature decided it should do because we didn't have a class action rule at the time we adopted the Consumer Act. And decided that it would be a good idea to allow class actions for Consumer Act cases. And so, as I mentioned this morning, they adopted the then version of Rule 23, the one that was in effect in 1966, as the basis for that. That rule has been changed since in many ways that really call out for a similar change to be made with respect to Consumer Act claims, because such things as class settlements, notice who's in the class, are not in the current version of 426.110.
My question
and
goes.
All we carved out were procedural.
Yeah, my question goes not to whether or not
it
should be changed. My question goes to who should be changing it.
Well, it's a procedural rule. We have not suggested changing anything other than the several sections that were that are entirely procedural were derived from Rule 23. Okay. We've left the substantive provisions alone.
Counsel, is there. Perhaps
I'm
misunderstanding Justice Bradley's concern, but it seems to be this, that traditionally when we adopt rules, it's somewhere in the range of Chapters 801 to 847. Is it significant at all that these procedural rules appear in Chapter 426?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't, you know, that's a matter for the reviser of statutes where these things go. And again, look at the sort. Why is it in 426? It's in 426 because we didn't have a rule to put into it. If they'd have said in whenever it was, the Consumer Act, apply 80803, they wouldn't have been helping anybody because it doesn't say anything. It says there could be a class action. And they were concerned about the sorts of things that judges are concerned about, like how do you give notice, you know, how do you pick counsel for the class, all of those things that we didn't have rules on. And so they.
So the legislature created it.
It did. It had created a statute that had in it significant substantive provisions and several sections of procedure, and we shouldn't have two sets of class action rules in the state, I say to you. I want to say one other thing, and then I'll sit down.
Before you do,
yeah.
The courts of appeal, the Court of Appeals has been developing rules for class actions in the absence of anything more specific in 80308. Has that been happening in Chapter 426?
I'm not aware of any procedural decisions under
426.
Okay. The only other thing I want to talk about is our proposal in Section 11 on appeals. We don't propose to change the law of Wisconsin at all, but again, it requires a little bit of exploration of why we're saying what we're saying. What we say here is the Court of Appeals may permit an appeal from an order granting or denying class action certification under Section 80803 sub 2 if a petition is filed with the Court of Appeals and provided in 80950. In other words, the rule we have now in Wisconsin by statute on interlocutory appeals allows someone dissatisfied with an interlocutory decision of the trial court to petition the Court of Appeals to hear it. The federal experience was different. The federal experience had only a final judgment statute, 1291, that said only final decisions could be appealed, and that caused so many problems in the federal system because, let me tell you, if ever a kind of case gives rise to a very appealing argument for interlocutory review in some cases, certainly not in every case, it's a class action certification or denial. Because if the class action is denied, the plaintiff effectively is finished, even though the case isn't over and you can't appeal yet. You've got to go to trial on the one that's left, and it isn't worth it. And substantial interests that should be vindicated in a class action can't be. Similarly, and this is all talked about in 2003 in the notes, similarly, if the class action is certified, a $50 case can become a $50 billion case. And the pressure on the defendant to settle what may be a wholly unmeritorious case is significant. And so in order to get around that, Congress actually passed a statute allowing the Supreme Court to enact a rule that allowed interlocutory appeals, which is what 23F is. And all it says is the same as 80803 sub 2 says, which is you may seek leave of the Court of Appeals, and the only reason we put a note in here about it when we pointed out 11, we weren't going to put in the federal language because we don't have Rule 23F, we don't have that statute. We wanted to point out that interlocutory appeals, specifically class certifications, present unique considerations as compared to other appeals, and the Federal Advisory Committee note is instructive and not binding and should be consulted. having in mind what the court has said sometimes, tell the people out there where to look. What we want to suggest here is that, you know, don't overlook the fact that this may be an occasion for an interlocutory appeal where it would be appropriate.
Now, Mr. Shiner, yes. The Wisconsin Civil Justice
right.
Wisconsin Civil Justice Council suggests making an interlocutory appeal available as a matter of right.
Right.
What do you think
that.
About that?
They suggested that to our committee. We considered it. We thought it was not a good idea. We so advised the council, which adopted that. And I'll tell you why we think that.
Okay.
First of all, I think that does take a change of statute. We've always treated 808 as a jurisdictional statute that this court was not free to waive. And 8080 allows appeals as a matter of right only from final judgments, orders, and whatever else decisions. So literally, I think this court doesn't have the authority to make them all appealable. This court has done the same thing in a different way only once. It's been asked to do it twice that I'm aware of, but has done it only once. And that was back in 1996 in Arneson versus Jerzwinski, where this court decided that it would figure out a way to allow denials of qualified immunity in 1983 actions to be brought up to the Court of Appeals. In order to do it, the court had to exercise and did its superintending authority over the Court of Appeals to order it to grant all petitions for interlocutory appeal where the denial of qualified immunity was based on a decision of law. This court could do that. We don't urge it to. It might do it in some future case as a matter of case determination. But that would be the only way, in my view, that this court could do that. And we don't think it's a good idea because there's still a lot of frivolous appeals going to be out there. And so we don't like that. One other time, as some on the court will recall, the court was asked to extend the Arneson versus Jaswinski rule to prior determinations of final judgments in federal court where the state proceeding had refused to give preclusive effect to the federal judgment. That was State ex rel Haas versus the Court of Appeals in 2001. The court declined to do that, in an opinion by Justice Bablich, with a dissent by Justice Abrahamson and Justice Sykes, so I'll tell you, like-minded people, right, decided not to do that. So the court has not been friendly to the idea of mandating interlocutory appeals. It leaves it to the discretion of the Court of Appeals, and we think that's the rule that ought to be adopted here, too.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I want to thank you, Mr. Shiner, as I have previously, that although this court has decided not to fund the Judicial Council, it's still on the books, and that the council is still operating and working as best it can.
We're doing our best.
No staff. So I just want to thank you once again for that and everyone else involved in the council.
Judge Fitzpatrick?
Good afternoon. I'm Mike Fitzpatrick, and I respectfully suggest that the court grant and adopt this petition. I'm on the Court of Appeals now and have been for all of 90 days, roughly. Before that, I was a circuit judge for 9 years. I was on the Judicial Council and this committee that helped draft this. While I was in private practice, I did not specialize, I don't want to overstate it, in class actions, but I handled several of them in federal court. And as a circuit judge, I did handle a class action. It was a case that, not on the procedure, but on the merits, came to this court. It was the Hormel case with the Donning and Doffing. And that one...
Well, that was yours, huh?
Yes, it was mine.
Was.
And so that one, I had to wrestle with certification issues and many other issues in that case. And in page 11 of your memo, it mentioned the 23-page opinion I ended up writing on just certification issues. That came before me. I'd like to very quickly make a few points that were asked in questions and make some other points. Justice Kelly raised the issue of the residual funds and money left over at the end, and you're right, it's counterintuitive that there would be money left over. on the table, so to speak, but in federal court, they've generally left that to the discretion of the district judge unless it was dealt with by the settlement agreement. But, and I can tell you that for whatever reason, it's almost always the case that money is left over. And the court here has told us, well, don't leave it to the circuit judge. We've decided what to do with it. So it does happen. Also on the Chapter 426 issue that was brought up, we believe that we would be remiss if we did not bring that to the court's attention, that there are class action rules in a particular part of the statutes. And as Mr. Schreiner said more eloquently than I could, we didn't think it was a good idea to have two different sets, very similar but just slightly different language sometimes, because that would leave practitioners and circuit judges wondering, well, gee, did they mean to say something different? We thought something that was standardized would be helpful, and if we didn't point that out to you, we thought we'd be remiss, and that's why we wanted to do that. There was also the question of whether there are, or whether Wisconsin courts are seen to be more protective of classes or certification of classes, and for that, I would suggest to see how people are voting, in effect. Where do people file most of the class actions? By far, federal court versus state, Wisconsin state courts. And these are, by definition, the plaintiffs want certification. They want it as a class action. They're not going to the circuit courts in Wisconsin as much, nearly as much as they are to the federal courts. And I'd ask that you keep that in mind as well. There's three areas I wanted to talk about. From my experience as a circuit judge, the reaction of a circuit judge when they are assigned a class action is, what do I do now? And this, and certainly Wisconsin is not a hotbed of class action activity, and I don't think this is going to change any of that. But a typical circuit judge, my educated guess would be, is going to see a class action maybe every 3 to 5 years. And I would ask you to think about it in terms of almost, in some sense, like an insurance policy. When you don't need insurance, you don't think about it. But when you need it, you really need it. And that's one way I'd ask you to think about this particular rule, because the current rule, it really gives very little help, I can tell you from experience, on very many issues. And there's been case law, but it's, some of it's quite old, from this court, and even there's not much from the Court of Appeals. This rule allows the gaps to be filled in from the current rule and the current case law for proper handling of a class action by a circuit judge. And I'll mention two very points really quickly. The first one is notice, the class notice. How do you do that? There's nothing in our current rule, or really nothing in the case law on that. And what circuit judges end up doing is saying, well, what do they do in federal courts? And so better than just to do it on an ad hoc basis, better to put that in. The other thing would be appointment of class counsel. All the case law says in Wisconsin is now, well, do it in a reasonable manner or something to that effect. Well, now it gives some standards, and those are two of many examples that I'd ask you to consider. The next point I'd like to make is the use that this would allow as persuasive authority federal case law. Let me be clear. It is this court's guidance as to what the law means in Wisconsin and the published opinions from the Court of Appeals that are consistent with this court's guidance that bind the circuit judges. But by using a large body of federal case law, I can tell you from experience, helps inform the discretion of the circuit judge in making various decisions. Inevitably, there will be questions that come up in a class action that cannot be thought of for the rule in the rule, and there won't be any case law guidance. And I'll give you an example. In the certification question that I had before me, the question that I asked myself but the parties didn't talk about is, what do I look at, what facts do I look at in order to make the certification decision? I haven't had a trial. I haven't heard witnesses. Do I just look at the pleadings, just the complaint, or may I go beyond it and look at the affidavits the parties gave me? Well, there's nothing in Wisconsin law about that, although indirectly there were a few things that I looked at, but it was very helpful to look at the federal case law, where you saw how another trial judge dealt with that very issue, and the upside of it was, or the information that I got was, well, you don't have a trial, but you can look at some affidavits and don't get too far into the merits, but get into it a little bit. It's that type of thing where, as one example, where the, using the federal case law, if it's consistent with what this court says, is useful. The final point I want to make has to do with subpart 6, having to do with potentially separate jury trials on separate issues. And I would suggest that this allows the flexibility needed for circuit judges in these types of situations. And you'll notice that the legislature in Chapter 426, when it created its own rules for class actions for consumer cases, that it took from Rule 23, allowed that you could have separate issues. And we would suggest the same thing here. Class actions are unique, and it's a difficult situation to deal with. I can tell you that the case that I had was going to be a jury trial, and then both sides stipulated to a court trial, and we actually had a trial. But if we would have had to have one jury on both liability and damages, there would have been an enormous amount of discovery done on damages, but not much on liability. It was relatively clear-cut as compared to damages. The parties would have spent an enormous amount of money on discovery, both sides, and maybe at a jury trial, the plaintiffs might have lost. I mean, and that happens in cases, obviously. And they would have spent an enormous amount of money. So I would suggest that you consider allowing, in this situation, separate juries on separate issues. And one of, I'm sure you're saying to yourself, well, Fitzpatrick, why didn't you just certify liability issues and then let damages be taken care of otherwise? And I considered that. But what would have happened is, with 330 people, if I would have done that, it would have been 330 small claims actions for about $3,000 each. The court commissioner time would have been 75 to 112 days, and then they would have had a right to a de novo review. So this is a very unique procedure, and I'd ask you to consider having the ability to have separate juries on separate issues. And I would suggest that this court has already done that in insurance areas such as bad faith. If there's a first-party bad faith claim, the Dahman case says you litigate the contract, whether there's a breach of contract, and then only after that do you do discovery and then have a trial on bad faith. And, of course, by necessity, you'd have to have two different juries for that. And I think the same would be true in bifurcation of other insurance matters. So yeah. This court has
Judge,
done that.
Judge Fitzpatrick, this comes by way of confession, I suppose, of the limitations in my own background of practice. But this is a... somewhat complicated rule. I think we can have some level of confidence that that the federal folks who have looked at this have done a good job in putting together Rule 23. But I'm uncomfortable about my own level of conversance in some of these issues. So, for example, we make distinctions in this rule for purposes of notice and judgment between sub 2A and sub 2B classes on the one hand and sub 2C classes on the other, and I'm not sure I even know what that means.
I didn't catch the last thing you said.
I'm not sure I even know what that means.
His confession is repeated. So.
This is my confession. Okay. And how concerned ought I to be that I'm not conversant in the distinction between 2A, 2B, and 2C classes?
Well, some of them are relatively rare, and I haven't gone back and memorized it either beyond what I thought I was going to talk about today. So if I'm somewhat vague, I'll confess that as well to you. You're the one with the robe on now, not me, so I'll confess that to you. But in any case, yes, it is not 49 words, but that's what we think the strength of this is, and we did not want to go back in and start tinkering, and I don't say that in a pejorative sense, but to start changing some of the language where maybe the judicial council would think, you know, maybe we could phrase that a little better, because then what we have is, then we have attorneys in front of circuit judges saying, see, now Wisconsin doesn't phrase it that way. They phrase it differently than the federal, so it must mean something completely different. And then what we're trying to do in order to help the circuit judges who are on the front lines is somewhat hindered in that situation. So
in for penny, in for pound.
It could be, obviously, it's up to this court.
Yeah.
We have very good counsel that's assigned. One of our commissioners, I'm sure, will do more research to help you out, Justice Kelly.
That was our generalized thinking on that particular point, rather than try to redraft anything, because we thought, well, we'll put this before you in the way that we thought was the best way for you to consider it, and we think is the best way for the circuit judges and all the judges in the state to use this rule. So that was. I hope that answered your question, Justice.
Yeah. It helps.
The bifurcation that you have is very much like Judge Shabazz ran his trials always, and I would imagine you practiced before him as I did. You had to get liability verdict before you were ever allowed to do anything with damage.
Yeah, absolutely, Chief Justice Rogenczak. And this takes it even the one step further to have a trial on liability, end it there, send that jury home, then do discovery, and then have a different jury, which, of course, would be different than, than the current case law, although, as I said, there are exceptions. This court has already built in to that already. But thank you. Thank you very much.
I think you should both rest assured that there is absolution.
Well, maybe for Justice Kelly.
Okay, Attorney Gleisner.
May it please the court, I'm Attorney Bill Gleisner, and although I've been a member of the Judicial Council and its Evidence and Civil Procedure Committee for 10 years, I have rarely appeared before this court regarding the work of the council. However, I'm also the representative of the state bar in the council, and so I speak today concerning the problems that the practitioners will face if we continue with the existing class action rule I believe they already face. For the past 43 years, I have researched and written and helped research and write numerous appellate briefs in Wisconsin and elsewhere. However, there are some things that you can't resolve with legal research. When it comes to class actions, what's a mother to do? You can't find answers very often in Wisconsin decisions. Are you going to go to one of the 43 jurisdictions that have some variation of 43? Are you going to go to one of the jurisdictions that have the field code? Where do you begin the research? How do you do the research? Where are the standards? Because there's a paucity of law on the subject in Wisconsin, you'd want to go to a foreign jurisdiction and say, this is the standard that I would suggest. However, if you do that, then you are going to be importing in not just foreign case law, but the rules, whether they be court rules or statutory rules from another jurisdiction, because very often that foreign authority is based on that. So what's a mother to do? You are in a very difficult quandary, and I would suggest that actually there might be a tendency among some not to go class action just because, like Justice Kelly said, it's not clear what these rules mean. And if you're dealing with rules from all kinds of different jurisdictions and a one-sentence or two-sentence rule from Wisconsin, that's difficult. So I am supporting this petition. I believe it will benefit the bench and bar, including the plaintiff's bar, the defense bar, the corporate bar, and any part of the Wisconsin bar that would, if this court were to adopt FRCB 23, because that would enable the bench and the bar to go to the decisional library of the federal court system, as is done now in e-discovery, and pull down relevant authority to help educate oneself on what the rules are, and to use the vast amount of authority that exists under FRCP 23. Whether you're a plaintiff or a defendant, that helps. There's a great deal of authority there that can help. And therefore, I respectfully urge adoption of this rule.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now,
Mr. Glenn,
I see that we have Justice.
I say something to him?
No, I don't mind. I'm sorry. I thought he was finished.
I want to thank you and your cohorts for bringing this rule to the court. And I recognize that, as I did with Mr. Schreiner, that the council is still in existence, even though this court is not funding it. So I appreciate that. And I think you should know that I stay with the position which the court has now not taken, that the court's discussion of these rules should be public, but it is now private, but I continue my dissent on that.
I will make one remark. I have taken not one dime for my work on the council in the last 10 years, and it's been my privilege and my honor. to serve on the council.
Thank you, it has done excellent work.
Now, I see that Justice David Prosser has joined us for this hearing. Justice Prosser, did you want to speak to this rule? No? All right.
No confessions, Justice Prosser. No confessions about shooting a man in Reno just to watch him die.
Okay. No. Now, we're going to have Attorney Schreiner come back. Do you have anything else that you
want? Just for Justice Kelly.
Yes, please.
You got a good job. If you get to wait until the issues are all sorted out, what do they say?
Yeah.
When the wounded are on the field, you get to come down over the hills and shoot them. You wait for these things to get developed. And people who practice class action right now, they know the difference between 23B, 1, 2, and 3, which is the source of these. I mean, basically one of them is, you know, civil rights cases where everybody's going to be affected. You don't have to notice everybody who's going to be affected because they're all going to be, whatever the one case determines is going to determine everybody anyway, or 23B3 where people have individual claims and you got to give a different kind of notice. But they'll all get sorted out by the time they come up here. And so just as a general proposition, if I could speak to what you were asking, I would hope that you wouldn't, any of you, feel you need to understand all of the vagaries of details of complicated rules before you can adopt them. You've got a lot of smart people working for you who can help you, and you've got colleagues who are smart. So.
Well, with that level of absolution, I'm very comfortable.
Okay. All right. With those comments in our hearing on the rule petition 1703 is concluded, we will meet in closed conference at half past at 2:30. Julie, I'd like you to join us, but the court has a very preliminary quick matter, so maybe at 20 minutes to 3, if you join us, we should be ready to take up the beginning of the rules. Thank you. We are adjourned.